He also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, "And how much do you owe?" He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." May God add his blessings to the reading of his word.
Would you pass that down to Pastor Chip? He's going to need his Bible. All right. Our pastors need their Bibles. I want to try to get this right, but this is the way I understood it. Coming in, Max was looking for a parking spot, and it's, you know, pretty full, and there's one left, and it says guest parking. So his friend Anderson says, "Bro, you can park there, but it's the last day that you can park there. You're not a guest anymore." Don't you love Baptism Sunday? That's amazing. Oh, man. Max, if you come back sometime and you need to park there, we'll get you a dispensation. So did you hear the one about the manager who was cooking the books and just skimming a little off the top and putting it into his pocket sees, keeping a little for himself, and he got caught, and he got fired, same day, game over, well, almost, because this guy was sharp, savvy, and he figured a way out. Jesus is the master storyteller. Like, don't you just want to hear that one? He is the master. Jesus was the master storyteller, and we're in this series on parables. We're back from Advent, and if you're just stepping in with us today, we've been doing parables since September. We're going to do a few more through January. And today, this powerful story is notoriously difficult. This is a hard one. Those of you who have been reading the scriptures for some time, you recognize this parable, you understand that it's challenging. It's notoriously difficult because Jesus is, it's like he's holding up a crook and saying, "Be like this crook." Jesus can't be saying, "Be like this thief," right? Which reminds us that parables are not moral example stories. That's not how they work. They're not short stories for kids. They're not self-help lessons for adults. They're not pro tips from Jesus on how to live well. Like, that's not what they are. Parables are stories that convey truth that is often hidden, like deep inside the story. And you have to pray your way into it or circle around it or hover over it. You got to think about it for a while before you get it. Or sometimes parables have a sting in the tail and they're convicting and exposing, and they capture us. Jesus gets us right where he wants us, and then we're ready for some serious gospel change. I think both of those things are true about this parable. So let's walk through the story one more time. I want to do story and then some application for you. So walk with me through this story one more time, and let's start in verse 1. There was a rich man. Does that sound familiar? There was a rich man. It sounds familiar because that's how both of the parables in chapter 16 start. We're going to do the second parable next weekend. So there was a rich man is an important expression. You'll have to leave it for the story to develop before you decide whether or not this rich guy is a good guy or the rich guy's a bad guy in both stories. So there was a rich man. Jesus frequently, like this reminds us that Jesus frequently talked about wealth and money. And I really had not intended to talk about money the first Sunday back, you know, because you kind of get in trouble sometimes, you know, in church. You're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't. And so, but here's why it's so important for Jesus to talk about money. And why he so often did, because it is so tempting, and you know this, to find your identity in your wealth. It is so potentially dangerous to find security in earthly wealth. It is so easily enthroned as a false god, because as the story ends, or as Jesus' statement about the story ends in verse 13, no one can serve two masters. You just can't. No one can serve two masters. That's what happened to this manager. That's what happened to him. He found himself having to decide, like, I really like working for this guy. I love working on this estate. He's done a lot to take care of me, but I like this even more. And so he started the deceptive, subtle process of taking, of stealing. He wanted more. We always want more, don't we? How much do you think will be enough? I imagine that the day started for a normal day like he and his wife were brewing up some Ethiopian coffee that they had imported through the estate, and they're having a little breakfast and coffee, and she says, well, what's on your agenda? And he says, well, not much. You know, I do have a meeting with the owner today. Oh, a meeting with the owner. What's that about? Well, nothing probably will come of it, but there have been some allegations against me and my business dealings. Oh, well, let me know how that goes. And look what happens in verse 2. Yeah, it's not a big deal at first, but it turns into a big deal pretty quickly. The owner calls him into the meeting and says, what is this that I hear about you? I thought I could trust you with my resources. I thought I could trust you with the estate. I thought I could trust you with the money. I thought I could trust you. And you have been recklessly spending, recklessly wasting this, I'm assuming, on yourself as well as in other ways. Well, I wouldn't say that. Well, I would say that. Why don't you go get the books? And it says in verse 2, give me the account of your management. He means the ledger books, right? The green book from Willy Wonka. Have you seen Willy Wonka yet? The green book, right? Like the ledger, the accounting of this. And he says, well, bring it in. The word that the story uses for wasting money, look over back into chapter 15. You'll remember the story of the prodigal son. What did he do with all the wealth and resources? He spent them recklessly. He wasted, same exact word, he wasted them on himself. So he says, show me the books. Apparently, it's not a long meeting. Those of us who've been fired know that brevity is important. and it's just pretty quick. He calls him in, and it's over. He's fired. Now, the scene changes. Did you notice this? In verses 3 and 4, the scene changes. This is a what poetry calls a soliloquy. He's talking to himself. Verses 3 and 4, we just get to see him by himself. I imagine in my mind that he leaves the meeting, and he's walking back across the estate, and he's just slowed down, like, he's looking out over the land. He's like, dang, I gave this up? What do I do? And he says in verse 3, what should I do? And he's just kind of stroking, you know, the thinker. He's thinking, what am I going to do? How do I get out of this? Where do we go? On his way back to the house that he's just been evicted from, I'm no longer strong enough to dig. I'm not young enough to work like that, to hire myself out as a day laborer. I'm not going to beg, verse 3. I'm ashamed to beg. That would be embarrassing. I'm not asking for help. I need a job. I need a place. I need an exit strategy. Verse 4. Aha. I know what I'll do. So that when I'm removed from management, people will receive me into their houses. Someone will give me a job. Somebody will give me and my family a place. I know what I'll do. This is good. So he starts calling, verse 5 says, he starts calling in the master's debtors one by one. Now, why do you suppose he would call them in one by one? I think he calls them in one by one because he wants to make a special deal with each one so that there won't be any question about who has blessed his life, right? So he calls them in one by one. And he's gonna change their lives, man. This is the kind of thing you see on TV, you know, when they bless someone with something they had no idea it was coming, right? Here's what happens. He meets one by one with them. He's gonna get credit. He's gonna do something incredibly helpful to them, and he's gonna call on that as his exit strategy in the days to come. A little quid pro quo. He's clever. He's creative, he's decisive, and he acts on it immediately. So verse 5 says, so summoning the master's debtors in one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe? He's going to cut him a deal and get in his good graces. Now let's talk about, are you with me so far? Let's talk about the deal, because it's hard to know exactly what he's doing. And there's three or four different options. I'm just going to give you what I think are the two best options. The first option on the deal is that he's just giving him a manager's discount. Everybody loves a manager's discount, right? This is what I can do for you, right? So he just calls him in, and he gives him a deal, and he blesses him, and he's hoping that dealing well with him with the manager's discount will turn out to be good as his exit strategy, when he'll go and ask for help from these. That's one way to do it, the manager's discount. The second way to read the deal, which I think is better and makes a little more sense of the text, he cuts a deal that traps the owner. What do you mean? Well, here's what I mean. Remember an Old Testament law that if you were to loan money to a fellow Jew, or loan wheat, or loan oil, or loan a commodity, if you were to loan something to a fellow Jew, you were not allowed to do that at interest. That would be called usury, and usury was forbidden in the law because you shouldn't make money on somebody else's misfortune. And there's good reason for that. But for time immemorial, people have found their way around the law. And not just the IRS, but the biblical law. And so, what these shrewd businessmen would do is they would figure out a way to charge interest. I want to charge interest, but I don't want to be seen charging interest. So, they would write or build into the bill the interest charge without accounting for it. For example, suppose you wanted to borrow $800 bushels of wheat. Well, you could borrow 800 bushels of wheat, but now you owe me 1,000 bushels. I built 25% interest in. So you get 800 bushels, but you got to pay back 1,000. No one knows that's really happening on the books because it's not put that way. But you couldn't report him to the Better Business Bureau. He might have the monopoly on wheat and oil in town. And what if you can't get any more olive oil? Like, you're in a sticky spot here. So you play the game, you pay the interest, you give back more wheat or more oil than you ever purchased to begin with. It's just it's a racket. Oh, I know what I'll do. I am going to trap the owner. So here's what he does. He calls these guys in. He cuts them a deal. He's able to give the owner the full principal back, but they don't have to pay the interest back, and the owner can't say anything about it. Because if the owner says something about not giving the interest back, he's incriminating himself and saying, I've been part of this dirty scheme to begin with. So now the owner's trapped. It's really, like, this guy's crafty. This guy's, he knows what he's doing. A brilliant plan. The principal of the loan comes back. The owner can't admit to it. And now those who were in debt to the owner are indebted to who? To the manager. They're indebted to the manager. And he's going to cash in on that as his exit strategy. This guy's good. Alistair Begg summarized it so well. He said, at this point in the story, once the story ends, or at the end of the story, essentially, the manager looks at his debtors and says, you owe me. While the owner looks down at the manager and says, you got me. That captures the story. J.B. Phillips paraphrased verse 8 like this. Now the master, verse 8, praised this rascally manager because he had been so careful about his own future. End of story. Now, the disciples are saying, wait, where is this going? They're all ears. And then Jesus starts in to the interpretation of the story, and he teaches us. Verse 8, second half. Do you see this? For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Mark that. All right, verse 8, one more time. For the sons of this generation, the sons of this world, the sons of this age are more shrewd, the sons and daughters, men and women of this age, are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the sons and daughters of light. I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. Let's start with what Jesus definitely is not saying. Okay, let's just kind of get that out of the way. Jesus is not commending dishonesty. In fact, in verse 8, what kind of manager is he called? A dishonest manager. The story has him described as a dishonest character. Jesus is not commending his dishonesty. No question about that. When Jesus compared himself and his second coming to a thief in the night, do you think of Jesus as a thief from now on? No, of course not. Jesus is not a thief. What he means to say when he says, I'm coming like a thief in the night, is that you would never expect the moment that I will arrive. And therefore, you should be watchful and you should be ready. Well, something very similar is happening here, right? So there's a big difference between applauding a dishonest manager for being clever and applauding a clever manager for being dishonest. The key word here is shrewd. Jesus is commending, he's commending the sons of this world and saying, as a bit of a rebuke to the sons and daughters of light and the disciples, how come we aren't? How come you aren't? How come those who want to live for God aren't shrewd and wise and careful and creative and intelligent and acting with urgency about something that matters way more than earthly possessions, right? See, do you see what he's doing? Too often, the world has more urgency, more financial savvy, and more relational awareness in caring for their own future than Christians do in caring about the gospel and eternity. If what we say is really true, oh man, we should act differently with more urgency with more awareness to redeem the time, redeem money and wealth, maximize friendships for the glory of God. That's what Jesus is saying. He's saying, I want you to redeem the time. I want you to redeem wealth. I want you to maximize friendships for the glory of God. Like, be the sons and daughters of light. Be the sons and daughters of the gospel. If anyone has reason to do that, you do. And I'm saying time, money, and friendship because the story is built on time and money and friendship. What do you mean? Let me try to show you how to redeem time and money and friendship for Christ. Time because of the urgency with which the manager acts. Do you see that in the unfolding of the story? He doesn't have a lot of time to sit around. He just left the meeting. It's over. The job is over. He's got to figure out his next step. He's got to move. He's got to be creative and quick, and he's got to act. And so there's a sense of urgency and timeliness. And also we think of time because Jesus speaks, I wanted to say clearly, but it's hard. Verses 8 and 9 are challenging in terms of the structure of the text. But what's pretty clear in terms of commentators and sorting through the understanding of these verses is that Jesus is making a contrast between this generation of the world and the generations to come, between now and then, between now and forever. That's how verse 9 works. So whatever else verse 9 means, it's talking about a contrast between now and forever. So that's why I'm saying time is an important resource. Time should be redeemed for the glory of Christ. Money, because the love of money drives the storyline. And then friendship, right? Because the word friend is very explicitly used in verse 9. Make friends. Like, I don't know how many times the Bible says this, but not a lot. I don't think there are a lot of expressions in the New Testament that say make friends. I need to do the math on that, but this is pretty rare to say it so clearly like this. So the point of friendship is when you buy friends with money, they don't last. But if you will submit yourself to the economy of God and start using your relationships and your friendships, if you will start seeing and practicing relationship and friendship in a way that doesn't use people but rather is used by God to bring the gospel to life, well, that's a game changer. So that's what verses 9 through 13, I think, are building out. And so I want to talk about how to use time, money, and friendship for Christ as we begin to kind of come in for a landing. But before I do that, some of you are bumping into verse 9. It's a hard verse. Let me try to just say what I don't think it means, and that might bring a little clarity to what you're sorting through. Verse 9 is hard. Okay, let's just admit that. And I tell you, so now he's interpreting the story. And I tell you, so this has happened, right? The sons of the world do this, and the daughters and sons of light do this. And I tell you, I'm interpreting, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth. It sounds like Jesus is saying, use dirty money to make friends. That's not what he means. What he's trying to say, I think, what the translators are trying to say, is that money is way too often used for inappropriate means. You know, money's neutral, right? It's currency. It can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing. Jesus is saying, take the thing that is so frequently abused and make it a good thing and employ it for the kingdom. Let unrighteous mammon or wealth have a righteous purpose. Don't buy your friends. Instead, invest your life and your resources into fostering the kingdom. That's what we think he means in verse 9. Earthly wealth is never the purpose. Like, earthly wealth is never for building your own kingdom. Write that on the tablet of your heart. If God has blessed you with earthly wealth, it has never been for building your own kingdom and your own family's kingdom. That's where the gospel collides with this. That's what Jesus keeps going after. So let me give you three workings, like three ways to work this out, three ways to live this out with regard to time, money, and friendship. And they come out of this section, verses 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Three things. Number one, be generous. Be generous with all three of those. Be generous with your time. Be generous with your money. Be generous in friendship. Be generous with your time. Invest in people outside of your own family and outside of your own purposes. Be generous with your money. Like, support missions and mission trips and give yourself. Go to Puerto Rico. Go to Marseille. Invest your resources there. Give to church planting in Winston-Salem or Blacksburg or in Chicago, wherever the Lord is leading, right, us to in partner in church planting. Be generous with your time. Be generous with your money. Be generous with your friendships. I think I'm becoming increasingly convicted that believers and disciples on mission should always be cultivating at least a family or friend or two who are either de-churched or unchurched or just straight up atheistic. Like, just because, like, you can't play the game this way. Like, I'm going to be their friend until I invite them to church. I invite them to church. I'm going to be their friend. They don't come to church. I'm going to stop being their friend. That is so bogus that we're paying for that as a church today. Because that's been practiced historically in the church at large. Evangelicals are paying for that right now. That's not what we mean. We mean love people, befriend them, no strings attached. There's so much power. Like, if Christianity doesn't have the corner on true, healthy friendship, where else in the world would you find it? Like, the motivation for real friendship. Be generous with your time, your money, and your friendships. Serve upward. Get involved in the upward basketball thing that's going on down here in the gym. And befriend a family over the next 6 or 7 weeks. Just befriend one family. And see what the Lord would do with that. Okay, secondly, be faithful. Verses 10, 11, and 12, pretty famous verses in the New Testament. One who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in little is dishonest in much. That is to say, don't expect if you have been not practicing that you can show up at game time and perform well. It won't happen. What comes out at game time is what you've been practicing. If you've been faithful in the little things, you'll probably be worthy of being entrusted with much. If you've not been faithful in small things, so that means time. That means money. That means relationships. It does not mean what the prosperity gospel teaches, which is really... When you start thinking about what's actually being taught in the prosperity gospel about money, like put money in the plate and then God will give you more back. I'm simplifying it, but you get the idea. That is so utterly ridiculous in light of the gospel. It'll just crumble under the weight of this parable and this passage. There's nothing there. Like, you're not supposed to even come close to worshiping money. That's going to be the next point. Be devoted to God, not money. You can't want more money than you want more God. Well, that's the third point. Be devoted. Stop letting money be your master. You know, the funny thing about possessions, and if you're honest with yourself, you'll admit this, that you want something to possess. You want that thing. You want that new thing, that new pair of shoes, that new car, that new house, that new husband, that new wife, whatever. Like, you want that thing. And then once you get that possession, what happens? It starts to possess you. It's crazy. It's really psychotic. It's broken. It's distorted. We think we're going to be happier with the things of this world. When they were simply, most of them, simply gifts that God gave us to be stewarded, enjoyed, managed, but not possessed by. So the parable ends with, no one can serve two masters. Stop trying. In fact, that's the point of the story. This guy, who's shrewd, well, he's just not shrewd enough. Even though he figured an exit strategy out, he's just not shrewd enough. Because money and possessions will never make him happy. You can't serve God and money. You just can't. Jesus is trying to make that point. And he's calling people. Well, yeah, so really the main point is stop giving all of your time, all of your creativity, all of your energy, all of your entrepreneurial spirit, all of your intelligence, all of your resolute, decisive, I'm going to go do this. Stop giving all of that like the sons and daughters of this generation do, and start doing that for kingdom purposes. That's the message of the story.